do it. Good morning. My name is Rob Vanilla. I'm a lifelong Delawarean. I went to St. Mark's High School and the University of Delaware. I have 3 low-digit black license plates. I know the owner of the Starboard in Dewey, and I've met Joe Biden 4 times. I love Delaware. If you say I don't, I can have you killed. My parents were dirt farmers right off a hardscrabble road. But now my sons, Grayson and Maximilian, are students at Friends, and I'm the senior vice president at JP Morgan Chase. I work my way up through school from Roy Rogers. Tuition was $11 a semester. I bought my first home in 1979 for $7,200. And I stand before you today against the minimum wage increase. Oh, I forgot to mention, I own 3 Arby's franchises. Sorry. Shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way Beast. Hello, this is Rob. This is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. We have a little bit to talk about today before we get to our main lesson. Carl is joining as always. Hello, Carl.
Hello.
And we have an important lesson. Carl has written a great 3-part series in The Call about the history and the rise and sort of fall of a teachers union that struck in 72?
They actually did in 72 and also 75. 75 was the big one.
Right, 72 and 75. And there's a lot of lessons learned, as there always is when we give you this history. So we're going to get to that momentarily. Before that, the SB 21 vote was yesterday. We're recording this on Tuesday. Wednesday. Today's Wednesday?
But we're doing both, yeah. We're doing Tuesday and Wednesday.
Oh, that's right. We're recording this on Wednesday. But anyway, you're getting it Friday, so it doesn't matter.
The vote's still the same either way.
Yes, the vote doesn't change since last night. I, for one, am pretty satisfied. Now, that is because I didn't follow any of the nonsense, like the House committee and all the arguments and all of that, because it's all bullshit. So I was satisfied that, you know, the bucket was stirred, the wasp nest was kicked, people were wailing, gnashing their teeth. That's good. That's good stuff. We've been working on this particular issue for 3 years, and while the current sort of heat around it has to do with Elon a lot and Doge and all that stuff, you know, the heat around it had to do with Elon before, so now people are kind of coming around to it, which I appreciate. But there's a part of it that I think I need to just make very clear, and it sort of goes into this working families party derangement syndrome. Like, I know that this process has broken people mentally. Like, you can't have those kind of confrontations in front of people that we know, you know, like, we know what's happening. You're breaking down. And that's fine. That's going to continue. The beatings will continue until morale improves. You know, I don't know what gives people the idea that, like, we're the legislators decide and then we just, like, shrug our shoulders, like, this is a democracy. Like, isn't that what I'm told? Like, we're losing our democracy, or our democracy's at threat, or maybe we lost it, or whatever. Like, everybody's really, like, you know, big on that right now. Well, in a democracy, see, the only thing we can really do in the legislative realm is threaten legislators with primaries and election challenges. That's just how that works. So, you know, if that hurts your feelings, or you're sad, or you're sort of having trouble dealing with it in some fashion, or you don't like it, that's fine. I would suggest you just resign. But beyond that, you could just not run again. Or you could run again and get beat. My post yesterday morning before the vote was very clear. I said it's a big day for the for the House Dems. Nobody, none of the seven representatives that voted no on SB 21 yesterday will lose a primary next year. Zero of them. Some of the representatives that voted yes will be losing a primary next year. Who will it be? Will it be you? Could it be you? Could it be you? So if you're nervous about that, you should be. Because I don't know if you've been following it for the last 6 years, but got a pretty good record in the win-loss column, if you know what I mean. And it's not going to stop. So stop fucking melting down about it. If you don't like it, don't run again. That's what I suggest. So, let's get into it. Once again, Carl has produced for everyone a really interesting local story that, I mean, it's so sort of, the lessons of it are really applicable, you know, all the way to today. We were talking about the Knights of Labor too, but this lesson was a little more recent. And you had written about this once before, or you had cited it, I think, once before.
Yeah, so the timing actually relates to the Senate Bill 21 stuff, because I forget exactly. I think literally the origin of this was I was on Twitter or X, the Everything app, or Blue Sky or some social media site, and one of the like working class history feeds I followed posted a map. I was like, oh, here's all the, we have a interactive map where you can see like working class history in your area. And I was like, ooh, that's cool. I'm going to look at Delaware. And there was one single entry in Delaware, which I think is a little unfair. We do have some labor history, as we've talked about, but it was from 1975. And it was Wilmington teachers being arrested at a sit-in at the Wilmington Administrative Building. I was like, oh, I've never heard about this before. And so that kind of launched it for me. So this was like a year or two ago. And so I just, you know, eat up a bunch of the different information about how that works. Or just the basics of what happened, what is this Wilmington Federation of Teachers, all that stuff. And I did some research, wrote out 80% of what ended up being these articles probably sometime in early 2024. And then we got really busy with elections, so I just did not have the time to put the final finishing touches on it. But what happened was in mid-February, we got word about SB 21 that came very quickly. And I'd already been thinking about talking more about the teachers unions because we have this upcoming education funding fight that is likely going to happen. There's talk about redistricting again. There's talk about teacher union stuff even.
Oh, yes,
like with the Brandywine teachers, they just didn't go on strike, but they had like some pretty contentious negotiations. So I was already like, oh, I need to revisit this. And then this SB 21 thing happened, specifically with the talk about Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg. And this just lights a fire in my head that I'm like, wait a second, this sounds really, really familiar. And the reason it sounded familiar is because this is the exact thing that they pulled back in 1981 with the creation of the Financial Center Development Act. They basically introduced this legislation and say you have to pass it by this date or you're going to lose out on all this business. And this was kind of the end result of a lot of work that Pete DuPont had been doing in the late 70s and early 80s to basically neoliberalize Delaware. And I talk about it in the teachers union story as just sort of the end result of the turmoil of the 70s and basically the resolution to that in the creation of the neoliberal state of the 80s. And so I was like, wow, there's a lot of parallels here. And so I want to just make sure this gets out there so that people know the story. Cause I think people who are in favor of this stuff actually know the story pretty well. But I think that those of us who have been fighting against this type of politics, we don't really know the story of where it comes from. And I think the idea of the story of the Wilmington Federation of Teachers, beyond just the very interesting things that happen in the story and the figures and the events and the lessons we can learn from it, more than that story in and of itself, I think it is also a story of how Delaware went from being a contested place where there was an opportunity for something more radical to emerge to what it has become today, and basically the invention of the Delaware Way, both politically and economically, that we know of it today. So the story basically goes from 1968 to 1982 that covers that development. I think as we're talking about SB 21 and putting it in more context, I wanted to talk more about just sort of the creation of some of these foundational myths of Delaware politics.
Yeah, it's the perfect timeline too, because, you know, I started out when interviewed Sarah a month ago or whatever, and just said that's really when it started, that late 70s sort of push. So what you saw from Carter to Reagan, and what you saw with, you know, the 81 financial bill here locally, that was, you know, that was a neoliberalizing of sort of everything. And I like that. I like those sort of that time frame, because I think that that's right. It fits right into that sort of neoliberalization of everything, of austerity.
And it's nice to be able to talk about it in very concrete terms, because people like to throw out the word neoliberal for various things, but
yeah,
I think we can get very specific about what it means in this.
Yeah, deregulation, austerity.
The use of the state specifically to benefit corporations through a market framework.
And, yes, yeah. exactly right. So how's this kick off? And you do start it all the way back in the late 60s, just to lay some sort of groundwork. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so the 1960s, and I don't mean to romanticize the 1960s in any ways, because obviously there was a lot of bad stuff going on, and honestly, in many ways, our government in Delaware was more conservative at the time. But there was an inkling of the roots of change, because this was something that was new to me, and just, I guess I hadn't really dug into Wilmington's history a lot in the way that I did in the last few years, but we think Wilmington's a black city. Like, it is, I don't know what the exact percentage right now, but it's one of the blackest cities in the country, and we have, like, a very strong tradition of black political engagement. But Wilmington did not become a majority black city until the 1960s. This was a very rapid development, basically after Brown v. Board, where, because the suburbs and the highways got put in the 1950s, a lot of the white working class communities were destroyed. And the ones that remained, they often would just flee once things started to get a little bit worse and deindustrialization was going on. And meanwhile, there was a lot of black workers coming in from the South. And so between, I need to find the exact numbers, but Wilmington went from being 7.6% black in 1950 to 43.6% black in 1970. So you have this sixfold increase in less than 20 years. And that is specifically concentrated in neighborhoods that, of course, now we think of as like historically very black, like West Center City, East Lake, Ninth Ward. Those went from being like 12%, 30% black to being super majority black in under 20 years. And this is accompanied with the increases of slumlords, of deindustrialization, so there's not as many jobs. You see the spike in crime and poverty. That's not because black people exist. It's because Wilmington's industrial base has been hollowed out, and the benefits that are coming from DuPont and other big corporations, they're going strictly to white suburbanites who are now fleeing the city. And so you have this rapid intensification of poverty, and everybody in the city is like, what the hell is going on? We need to deal with this. And so even like the liberals, like the white liberals and white moderates, so even the Greater Wilmington Development Council or whatever, the DuPont-backed organization, they're like, we want to do anything we can to deal with this issue. And the example I use in the piece is the Wilmington Youth Emergency Action Council, which was founded in 1967, and it basically recruits. It's very similar to what we think of like StreetPAR or the Center for Structural Equality today, where it recruits gang members, like people from the streets, and hires them to run social programs to benefit urban youth. And it was inspired by like this Alinskyite person. And it's like a pretty radical, like they bring in a lot of people that are very radical for the time. And it's funny because it's getting all this like federal money. It's getting some like local nonprofit money, but they're advocating for things that are not just liberal, but like radical and redistributive and giving resources to people who've never had resources before. And so you have, you know, the People's Settlement Association as well, historically was like a white-led organization. In the 60s, it switches over to focusing on black poverty. They're doing things like supporting rent strikes. they're doing welfare protests. They actually went and occupied Legislative Hall in 1968, right before MLK was assassinated. So you had all this radical energy building, and then Martin Luther King's assassination, you get the occupation of Wilmington, which really just suffocates a lot of the... So in WEAC actually gets shut down, the Youth Emergency Advisory Council, because they found a couple of youth that were like doing target practice out in Cherry Island landfill, and they were wearing signs like, I've been... I think probably ironically, just knowing how people tend to talk, like, I've been drafted into the resistance army or something. But, you know, they see like, oh, these guys are going to like start more of a riot. So they shut down WEAC. In Dover, there was actually a big protest with DSU. At the time, they were trying to bring it into University of Delaware and strip it from its HBCU status. And so there was a big protest. The student president there gets arrested or kicked out for leading this protest. So there's this huge crackdown in 1968. But that's also kicking off of the piece, because at this point, Wilmington's education system is incredibly black, because generally, if there's a big population shift, you see it first in the schools, because that's where the younger people are. So that's what the new generation. And so this is around the same time that teacher unionism is becoming a thing. And I actually did not have this. I was talking to some DSEA folks after this came out, just because they were reading the piece, and they recommended this book that was super... It confirmed a lot of what I had already sort of assumed. But there's this interesting thing. This is from someone in DSEA. So it's a more conservative, small-c conservative take on this.
Because, so this was written by a DSEA...
Yeah, a former DSEA guy.
Okay. Is it a recent book? Or
I don't know. I think it's semi-recent. Like, it's... when was it published? 2013. So yeah, semi-recent.
Okay. Semi-recent. Okay. What's the name of it?
A Reluctant Revolution, DSEA in the 60s. And so this is the chapter on the Wilmington vote specifically. So even after the riots settled down, Governor Terry refused to pull the troops out of the city for fear that the riots would flare back up again. Mayor Babiarz, I don't know how to pronounce it. I've read this many times. It's a Polish name. Civil rights leaders and business leaders requested an end to the occupation, but the hard-nosed governor would not back down. If you were a teacher in the city and you drove past armed guards on every street corner on your way to and from school every day, could you help but think of the race issue and the memory of Martin Luther King? And Martin Luther King specifically was no stranger to the AFT. So this is the national of the Wilmington Federation of Teachers. Albert Schenker, the president of the New York City affiliate, had visited King in the Birmingham jail. The Federation had photos of King and Schenker, as well as an endorsement of the AFT. And so basically this becomes a race issue and a radical issue within the teachers union election. And the Wilmington Federation of Teachers wins this huge upset victory, basically running on a more race conscious and more explicitly radical platform of like, we're teachers, we're workers, we're black, and we are going to try to run a union that actually really benefits our members in a more militant way. And even though a lot of the radicalism got tamped down in 1968, it also gives birth to this new organization and this new kind of strategy of making change in this more militant unionism.
Can you explain sort of the just briefly, people are familiar with DSEA, and that's talking about DSEA. Can you sort of talk about how this other organization sort of interacted with them? Was it independent? Was it part of it? Can you kind of talk about how that works? And I don't know if a lot of people, because our labor saturation is not what it was.
It's not super great. Yeah.
Nobody kind of gets like, oh, there's actually multiple teachers unions in the country today.
They're there's still two major ones.
There's still two major ones, but I don't know if everybody sort of knows how that works.
Yeah, so DSEA actually started as a professional organization back in the 19-teens. And essentially, it was an organization of educators more broadly. So that meant teachers, but it also meant administrators. And it was an all-white organization to start out. They banned black membership. And in the 1930s or 1940s, I don't remember off the top of my head, there was sort of an activist base within the DSEA that was like, we want to desegregate. And DSEA refused. And so they split off and formed the Wilmington Federation of Teachers. And so the idea of WFT was a local of American Federation of Teachers, which was started in the 30s. Neither of these organizations were able to collectively bargain because they were in the public sector, but DSEA was a education advocacy group, whereas WFT was a union, even if they weren't able to bargain officially. And so they split off. There's a lot of people who held cards for both organizations because they kind of were doing different things. And eventually they did force DSEA to desegregate in the 1940s, but they kind of continued on as separate organizations. WFT was known as sort of like the more militant, teacher-focused, activist and black organization. DSEA was known as like, we're not really a union, but we're like advocating for teachers.
Yeah, I think of them like a advocacy lobby group.
Exactly. You
know, special interest group.
Yeah, sort of like how you think of like the American Medical Association almost. Like it's not even, it's not a union, but it's almost a professional organization.
Yeah. And I know, maybe I'm wrong. The teachers themselves in DSEA do get some sort of benefit. I think they get some professional insurance and things like that. And you do get some representation for issues that come up. So it's not simply a lobbying, a special interest lobbying.
Yeah, it's like a, but you get some stuff.
Yeah, but it's not what you would think, like you said, a militant trade union.
Yeah, but then in the 1960s, there's this movement across the country that comes to Delaware as well to allow public sector bargaining. And DSEA is like, well, we went in on that. And so they really transformed themselves very quickly to become more of a teachers union. And then WFT... because of the situation in Wilmington, they kind of beat them to the punch there. But DSEA tends to win all the other elections across the rest of the state in these majority white areas, whereas DSEA or WFT wins in the majority black areas. So they win the Wilmington school district and now also the Delmar school or De La Warr school district, which is what used to be like
the Newcastle,
Newcastle Route 9 corridor area.
Yeah, it's colonial now.
Yeah. And so they had this election in 1968, and WFT wins this, shock victory, even though they had fewer members. It was just a much more militant organization. They win their first contract after a few months. They threaten to strike. They don't actually strike, but they end up winning. I don't know at which point it became like this, but Wilmington teachers by the 1970s were the second best paid teachers in the entire country behind Chicago, which when you think about it now and the fact that we're behind every other state around us is crazy.
Yeah, that is wild. Yeah, talk a little bit about I thought it was really cool that you went back and were sort of able to tell the story of the second part of the negotiations and the strikes themselves. They did strike me as very Delaware stories, just the characters and like the way that the negotiations went. I don't know why that is. Maybe it was the way that they were covered here, and so that's the history that we have. But yeah, talk a little bit about that because they struck twice.
Yep.
And were they negotiating with a group of people who were a very interesting lot, we'll say.
Yeah. So in 1968, you have the election of a new mayor and a new governor. So I forget the mayor off the top of my head, but you get Russ Peterson at the governor level. And these are both like liberal business Republicans. So people who believe in civil rights, they believe in good government. They believe to a certain extent in like spending and like having good public services, but they're also Republicans. But in 1972, you get the backlash to that. And so you get a conservative Democrat in both the governor's seat and then also at the local level. And so the Democrat locally is Thomas Maloney, who was sort of like discount Joe Biden is kind of how I see him, because he's also like a young guy, kind of liberal coded, but has actually fairly conservative politics when you look at it. And what's going on in the 1970s is you're getting the hangover of the post-war boom is now starting to like really take effect, where we're not quite in peak stagflation at this point in the 70s, but we're starting to see the real effects of it. And the Nixon administration also, especially in the first term and then continuing into the second term, they're like really cutting down a lot of these Great Society programs that had funded, that created the ability to have like strong welfare programs and really good education and environmental protections, all that stuff. So all that stuff's getting cut back while the economy is overall getting worse. And so the most famous example of this was the 14 New York, go to hell, or whatever the headline was.
Oh, yeah, because they were going to let New York burn.
They were going to let New York go bankrupt.
Yeah.
And so Maloney comes in. He's like, I'm a fiscal austerity guy. Like, we need to cut spending. And part of that is, like, all these Wilmington teachers are getting paid a lot, so we can't be paying them as much anymore. Whereas the teachers are like, well, inflation's going up. We need to get paid more or else we're not going to be able to afford to live anymore. And so you have this confrontation that's starting to build in the early 1970s. And at the same time, though, the ability to get black representation is expanding because Wilmington's only getting more black. And the governor had put on some people on the school board because that was appointed at the time to make it a majority black school board. And Thomas Maloney realizes, like, oh, I got to kind of do that too. But he finds, like, a different set of people that are going to be a little bit more acquiescent to what he wants. And so the new chair is Warren Howell, I believe his name is. Wendell Howell. And he was someone who, like, was kind of a community guy, but then this is a archetype that we maybe can recognize in a few other cases.
I'm looking over at Pierre, the turtle bell.
Yeah. And then he kind of got recruited by the local machine to run against a beloved local politician. So he was, like, kind of on the outs, but he gets recruited onto the school board with the understanding that he's going to play a little bit more hardball. So there's, like, a quick strike in 1973. It doesn't really go anywhere. But in 1975, there's two strikes. So the first is this statewide DSEA strike where they want to raise, or they were promised a raise that they don't actually get. And Sherman Tribbett, who's now this conservative Democratic governor, he bends over backwards to give them a raise, but they wanted to do a gas tax, and the gas tax is, they basically, the refinery, which is still there, threatens to leave if we pass this gas tax. And so they veto the gas tax. So then this leads to a strike. They've eventually resolved it after a couple of weeks, and they find another source for the raise. But later in the year, there's now a bigger fight that's playing out at the Wilmington level because they have a lot less wiggle room in their budget, and the teachers are a lot more militant. And so this leads to, in the fall of 1975, you have a big teacher strike, and there's a lot of different players. So there's the teachers, obviously, who are in favor of themselves. There's the district, which is in favor of stopping the strike no matter what. But then you have the community and the parents. And so in Wilmington, the PTA had kind of split off into this group called the Home and School Council. And it's a little bit more community-led, it's a little bit more activist, and they initially are siding with the city to basically say, like, yeah, we want to get our kids back to school. But then the teachers union president, James Warnick, he speaks to them, basically gets them on the side, is showing that they're trying to negotiate. And eventually the teachers are now on the parents are now on the teacher's side. And this leads to, like, some increasingly militant tactics. So at one point they're working with the AFL to try to start a general strike so that all of the AFL unions are going to go on strike in support of the teachers. That ends up not panning out. But they also have this sit-in in the administration office where all the teachers come out there and the parents are there as well. And they basically blockade the school administration building and get arrested. Like, it's a mass public demonstration. They all get arrested. They're singing "We Shall Overcome." And eventually they're able to force the district back to the negotiation table. And they ended with a compromise, but given what was being asked, the compromise was a lot better than they were going to get otherwise. It gets, like, pretty contentious, but the big thing is also the Court of Chancery, of course, they step in.
We love them, folks.
And they end up and part of what drives the teachers union to the table as well, and, like, is that they're getting fined several thousand dollars basically every day. And by the end of it, they end up with $18,000 in fines. And this is 1975, so that would be, like, a lot more money today. And so basically they've kind of kneecapped. They get a good contract for the most part, but they, in the process, basically use the legal process to kneecap the Federation of Teachers. And then that leads into the desegregation fight in 1978, which I do think that 1978 to 1982, that's the real crucial step of, like, there's been all this conflict, there's been all this crisis. And there was a legitimate fiscal crisis, which I should try to emphasize. Like, I do blame them for taking an anti-labor tact on it, but it's not like this was the only place where this was happening. It kind of explains why it happened the way that it did. But Yeah, this is our sort of last gasp of these this militant energy of the 60s, kind of being able to really put a stake down and win real benefits for people.
Yeah, our boy Russ Peterson, really did, he loved the environment, really didn't keep a good book, though.
Yeah,
books, books were not kept in proper form. But yeah, so they do, while it's a compromise, they do get the city back to the table.
Yep. They're still the best paid teacher, like one of the best paid teachers in the country.
So now we get to the 78, 79 time where we have both things sort of happening together, the desegregation fight, and then this idea that we can create sort of a usury wonderland here, I guess, or whatever you want to call it. So yeah, that sort of is the main time for part three. So yeah, can you give us a little background about where that came from? And I think a lot of people understand what the financial part of it was, because some of those big buildings are still down there for the same reason.
And so, you know, during this process, there had been constant budget crises. So the thing that happened with Russ Peterson that got him thrown out in 1972, that was a budget crisis. 1975, you have another budget crisis around the Getty oil tax and all that stuff. And so when Pete DuPont comes in, our man of the hour, unfortunately, one of my least favorite people, I think, in history, just because of the relation to Delaware, he basically is like, okay, he has some good ideas and he has some bad ideas, let's say. Because he does sincerely want to get the state's budget back on track, which it was a real issue. The state's budget was an absolute mess, had been for decades at that point. And so DFAC, which we talk about constantly now, that was a Pete DuPont invention. The ability to only raise taxes if you have a 2/3 majority or a 3/5 majority, that was a Pete DuPont invention. And so basically he's doing a lot of like kind of regulatory things to make it more difficult to spend, but also more difficult than the tax. And while this is going on, the desegregation order is moving through the courts. And so in 1978, this has been like a multi-year process. There's a whole interesting story there that I just didn't have time to get into. And honestly, I don't understand it super well. That'd be, you know, if like Tizzy wants to come back in at some point, maybe she can tell that story a lot better than I can. But in 1978, he released the order that we're going to do, the federal judge releases an order, we're going to do one countywide school district. And then eventually that gets split into the four that we know now. But an interesting thing that doesn't really often get talked about is that he set a max tax rate that the school district could have, which basically guaranteed that the teachers overall would not be able to be paid the same amount that Wilmington teachers were being paid. So just like a little legal thing there that often doesn't get talked about. And so in 1978, there's going to be now a new election for teacher representation in the now Newcastle County School District. And at the end of the day, it was kind of it was never going to be any other way, but it still broke down on race. It still broke down on radicalism, and DSA washes WFT just completely. The WFT was running basically on the idea like, hey, we'll do for the county what we did for the Wilmington. We'll like get you the best pay. But at this point, just like the membership differential was too big. They didn't have the 1968 energy, and so they get wiped out. They still represented some like paraprofessionals, and actually there is still one AFT local still. The Brandywine School District paraprofessionals are still represented by AFT and the Wilmington Federation of Teachers. So they're still out there. But in 1978, that then leads DSEA, one of their promises basically to win over some of the WFT people is like, oh, but we'll still go on strike. Like, well, we're still going to try to get you the Wilmington wages, but we're going to go on strike to do that. But it just was not a well put together effort. And at this point, the tone of everything has changed so much in those last 3 years. Like, everything is becoming more conservative. You've had the tax revolts. You had the PAC in Delaware, which was like the conservative anti-busing group. There's just a lot more energy, and Pete DuPont is actually able to win over the parents on the side of the state this time and not on the side of the teachers, and they're not able to level up, which is what they called it, of getting their wages raised. And also the Wilmington Federation of Teachers, because they're still very loyal to the WFT, they don't go on strike because they're like, you guys have actively slandered us. You don't want to win anything for us. You just want to get you guys what we already have. Screw you. And so there's a lot of racial tension. There's a lot of different stuff going on. And just the teachers are totally split, powerless. They get washed in the strike. And so that kind of, there's, you know, other union, like AFSCME is obviously still building up at this time as well, but that really defangs the teachers as a political force, or an economic force really at that point. And by 1980, with his reelection, Pete DuPont is now ready to put that, you know, the jewel in the crown of the Financial Center Development Act, which makes it so that we slash credit card rates. And this is based off like a recent court decision as well, that like if you incorporate in a state, then those like all those regulations apply for wherever you sell your credit cards. So this is like based on a recent court decision. They wanted to get out, the banks wanted to get out of New York because there's too many regulations. And they said, if we come to Delaware, you have to pass this law within like 2 weeks or else we're not going to move. And they literally give a press conference and say, hey, we have this great legislation. It's going to bring so many jobs to Delaware. And if you don't pass it in by, literally, it was like the press release was in mid-January. And they said, if you don't pass it by February 4th, we're not moving. And so it was very similar. Like, if you look at the breakdown of how it happened, very similar to how things have played out over the last few weeks. And I know it's not a great analogy for me because the jobs did come. Like, Jordan's piece back from a couple years ago around the East Side and the destruction there, that's what finally filled up the blank space that had been left for decades in the East Side, was all these bank buildings that moved in the 70s or in the 80s and the 90s. And so, yeah, it was a very similar process. I also told the story of the heads of Hercules and DuPont also played a similar game. I think the policy is a little bit more similar because they basically said, like, hey, this hurts our feelings that you have to tax us this much. And even though these taxes don't affect 99% of people, we want you to lower them so that we can move more corporate executives here. And Pete DuPont was like, okay. And so they slashed the top tax rate. We used to have a tax rate above $100,000 in the 70s. And if you made above $100,000, you were taxed at 19.8%. And they slashed that to 13.5%. And then obviously by the end of the 80s, they had slashed it even further. So you have this, without the ability to really fight back in any meaningful way, you have the complete slashing of those top tax rates, regulations, and it does benefit parts of Delaware. Like, our budget was in a much, like, our budget has never been, isn't in as bad a shape as it was in the 1970s ever since. So, like, they did do that correctly, and part of what they did was they did by just taking a lot of the Democratic ideas around taxation and economic policy, they just took that off the table entirely and said, like, nope, this is not a Democratic decision anymore. We're going to do this in the back rooms. We're going to do it in DFAC. We're going to do it. We're going to centralize it in OMB. We're going to say, you know, the corporate law council at this point becomes more more influential. So they basically take all these things off the table, and it has some benefits. Like, our budget becomes much more stable. But I mean, just look at what happened in Wilmington over the next 30 years after that. Things did not get better for people in Wilmington. Our education system didn't get better. Our teachers are paid worse. And what it has led to is this very acquiescent, undemocratic culture. Because if you look at some things that were happening in the 1970s, obviously on the labor side, but in the legislature as well, it was much more combative. There was much more of an open democratic question around how things run. And obviously it was not good because it led to outcomes in many cases that were not the good outcomes, but we've taken away this idea that anything else is possible, whether it be militant labor action, whether it be more open political contestation of the budget. All these different things that used to exist are now completely off the table. And I think in our modern political culture, and why I think this story is so important, is it shows that things used to be different not that long ago. There's people, I mean, I was, Joe Connor, every time I published a new article, he would text me and be like, oh yeah, this reminds me of like this. Like, there's people around who remember all this stuff and went through it. And I think a lot of them took their lessons as like, oh, we don't want to do any of that again, which is fair. Like, it did suck in a lot of ways. But I think it is an important story to tell because we think of our status quo as basically unchangeable. And I think what this shows the story of the Wilmington Federation of Teachers, and essentially after the 1978 thing, they just start to slowly die out. Like I said, there's still one local left, but, you know, it shows that there is another world possible, and that kind of leads into, like, the most recent piece I wrote as well that I want to talk about.
And I think it's funny because you mentioned it quickly, and I just wanted to comment on it a little bit because I was, you know, I was a beneficiary of bank jobs.
Yeah.
You know, and so there was a benefit because those jobs technically did come. Now, they've gone back and forth, and they've put a lot of those sort of middle-level professionals on like a hamster wheel. So you get laid off here, you got to try to go there, you got to try to network around here and there. And so it's not as great on the, you know, the affluent worker as you would think. And also, like you said, the thing that we cannot forget is we continually exacerbate problems that we're trying to solve now that were created and exacerbated from the very beginning. Because nobody cared to do anything about, you know, teacher salaries or education or housing or
poverty
in general or whatever. It was just like, well, if we can ship in some new people, and, you know, we'll build up Middletown for them so they can stay further away, you know, that kind of stuff. Now, there's been a little bit of a resurgence in Wilmington in the last 5 or 10 years because, you know, there people make money off of building buildings.
Yeah.
So you can do a little bit of like a sort of a cosmetic thing. But that's all it really is. It's using the machinations of capital to make sort of cosmetic changes. And once you get into that groove, it's like exactly what you said. It's like, it can only be this way. Like, yeah. How would we ever function if we didn't do this? Like, well, I don't know, but it's creating a lot of problems and I think we should figure it out.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. Cause that's the lesson I was taking from it. And like you said, it's playing itself out. And SB21 is an exact, you know, example of how it plays itself out. Not in the exact policy, but in this idea that this is the only way that it's done. You know, we have to make these capital concessions so the budget looks good. Of course, our housing issues and our poverty issues and
education
issues, like the teachers, they're all still going to be shitty.
Yeah.
But at least the numbers, you know, we look at the spreadsheet, the numbers worked out. And so that's all we're really looking at.
Yeah. And I think Representative Griffiths made a statement when she was finally, so all the amendments had failed, and she was giving her presentation on why you should vote for SB 21. And one of the things she said that I thought was very telling, and I don't think it was telling in the way that she meant it to be telling, was she talked about DuPont and MBNA and said, remember all these great things that existed in Delaware in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and now they've left and we can't get them back. And this is just to show that these things, you know, even though we have this great corporate system right now, it doesn't mean we're always going to have it. And I think what she meant it was, is that we need to do whatever we can to hold on for dear life for these things. And anything that we need to do in order to keep them is absolutely necessary. That's how she meant it. But I think the way that I think about it personally is that is why you cannot set up your system to be around catering to the interests of billionaires. Because as soon as they have any whim that they don't like you anymore, they're going to take their ball and go home. And that kind of gets to the last point, which is the need. And Representative Gorman, I'll probably text her one-on-one as well. You mentioned the need to like diversify our revenue. Like, let's talk. Because obviously this system is not sustainable. Like Representative Griffiths said, it can slip away really quickly. I don't think that the like Leave Delaware Twitter account that is not an insignificant part of why people are having this discourse around a Dexit, I don't think they're going to suddenly be like, oh, actually, no, Delaware's great again. No,
yeah, that's
not
the thing. And that's, I, of course, one of the things, and I recommend this to anyone, you know, don't listen to the floor debates. Don't go to the committees. Don't make public comment. None of it matters. So I hadn't heard that. But again, I worked at MBNA, and my grandfather worked at DuPont. Obviously, many friends worked at DuPont. the reason that these companies don't exist anymore has nothing to do with, like, you dropped the ball. Like, the capital is going to make its decision regardless. You could potentially do everything, and they're like, you know what, we're still not doing it. Or yeah. situation has changed.
Yeah, literally,
like,
I just looked
you're not
at this.
Like you said, you're not doing anything long term. You're just every year giving more of the store away until such time as it falls down. Like, DuPont as an organization and MBNA as an organization didn't get sold for parts or spun off or collapse in some fashion or whatever because the taxes went up. That's not what happened.
Yeah.
So it's just like, I don't know, because people wanted to make decisions to leverage their capital and make more money. People got laid off and businesses shuttered. So it's like the idea that what you're doing is some sort of heroic, you know, that you've done something heroic, I think is fucking stupid. And I'm glad that you pointed that out to me, because it's like people can't just say whatever they want to say without some sort of pushback on this one.
Yeah.
Since, like, I was here for it.
Yep. And I just checked the Leave Delaware. And obviously, like, Leave Delaware, I don't think this is necessarily a representative sample of, like, all the big corporations, but...
So this was the... This was, like, the defense firms and stuff?
So this is... this Twitter account existed. It's Elon Musk related. I don't know if it's literally Elon Musk or just people who really like him.
Okay.
But they've been doing a lot of discourse. Like, a lot of the... It's not directly tied to the defense firms, but there's a lot of, like, kind of common links. And so this is just tweeted yesterday evening. Senate Substitute 1 for Senate Bill 21, aimed to balance Delaware's corporate environment, has passed the House of Representatives. Let's keep the pressure on. Leave Delaware. This didn't do anything. Like, if you really think, for those hardcore people that have had it in their mind that Delaware is woke now, and so, like, all the based corporate executives need to leave, which is, like, these Silicon Valley and Wall Street people, they're going to leave anyways. So it's, I like, maybe there's certain people, like I said, I'm not a corporate expert. I'm sure that there's individual companies that are like, okay, now we're fine. We'll stick around. But we do know that CalPERS, all these big institutional investors are now super pissed off. And a lot of them might vote for the companies they do have control of to leave. And a lot of these, like, Silicon Valley, Wall Street companies, they don't like Delaware because it's Delaware. It's a blue state. It's woke. They hate Elon Musk. So they're going to still leave. So my contrarian opinion on this for both sides is, like, I don't know if it really makes a big difference whether or not this passed in terms of Delaware's corporate status. I think it's really bad for the country as a whole, because now plaintiffs in all Delaware companies do not have the same rights, or stockholders don't have the same rights that they used to. And that is now going to become the norm everywhere. So there's not really going to be any states anymore, because they want to, you know, we've set a new level. And so it just kind of sucks. I don't think maybe I'm wrong. Like Medina said, I pray that I'm wrong, because I don't want things to get worse. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I said it a week or two ago. Ultimately, it doesn't really matter. Like, because the numbers that we're talking about, whether they would have not have passed this, the people who have left would not have collapsed our budget. And now other companies could leave because there's not as many shareholder safeguards, so they could leave. That's not going to collapse our budget either.
Probably.
The issue is that next year there'll be some other kind of wild thing where, oh, you know, we need the ability to do this. It was market practice. We need the ability to do this or that or whatever. It doesn't end. And the fact of the matter is there's capital is going to make decisions in a political environment, and there's no, like, oh, all we have to do is just, like, fix this. You're not fixing anything. You're just, you're addressing a small cadre of lunatics to make sure that there's not a panic.
Yeah.
That's all you're doing. Like, this is not some sort of, like, you're not a hero. You didn't solve it. You didn't solve anything. Nothing's solved. That's the thing that I'm like... You know, they're able to jam through this bill in a month or a few weeks or whatever. They can't do diddly dick on anything else.
Yep.
But this, man, they can hop fucking too, and yeah, it doesn't solve any problem. We were able to make a huge sort of circus of it, which I as I said at the beginning, I'm very happy about. We will continue to do stuff like that. But let's be perfectly honest. If I were some of the people who are like getting upset about this, I would feel kind of stupid because you didn't have to do any of this. Like, it was going to pass anyway.
Yeah.
We said that 3 weeks ago. I could have told you before I even knew what SB 21 was. You know, we're sort of in a holding pattern. We have a group of seven representatives that sort of understand what's happening. You know, we just need to grow that group. But yeah, to get yourself all worked up and get your pants in a twist and yelling at each other and fighting and having mental breakdowns and crying and all that stuff, like, dude, I mean, it passed the Senate unanimously and you got seven no votes in the House. Like, yeah. Why'd you get so fucking worked up about it?
Because they want to feel like they're good people and they're not, doing good things.
So just they're not. Yeah, and that's why we're here, to tell you that you're not. You didn't solve any problem. You didn't do anything good. You capitulated to capital because you were scared. That's it.
Yeah, and there's two things that I kind of wanted to close on. I think we have a bit of time if
cool,
you
cool,
keep
cool.
talking.
Yeah, go. Let's go.
Two points that I just want to make in terms of like what comes next. Because I think, like Representative Gorman said, like, we cannot rely, and the number keeps changing, and I noticed that they kept increasing it every...
Almost 30, nearly 30,
was,
40, 41,
yeah,
29?
So now apparently it's half our budget. I don't half know if you knew this. But like obviously, it's a big portion of our budget. It's basically the portion where a sales tax in any other state would go. But like clearly, we cannot rely on this to be everything in our budget the way that it currently is. So we do need to find different ways that ideally aren't a sales tax. I do agree, even just on it from a lefty perspective, that sales tax, it's a regressive tax. Like, it's not good. And we do have benefits from not having a sales tax beyond that. Like, I think generally everybody's on the same page that we don't want that, but we've got to figure something out. And I don't have all the answers. I know we have some legislators that are working on that because our budget, you know, it'd be one thing if it was just this. We also have the Doge stuff, the Trump stuff. Like, we talked about how in the 70s, one of the reasons that the local budgets were struggling so much was because of the Nixon administration. We're in a similar situation now with the Trump administration where, like, it's going to hurt some of our local budgets. So we need to figure something out. So I think that really need to be, of anybody who said that, oh, we had to vote for this for XYZ reason. If you were serious about that, you need to be part of the conversation to bring in actual progressive sources of revenue that don't just fall on taxing the things that working people need. And maybe that means taxing the rich. Like, a progressive income tax is a good start. That's not going to do all of it because it's not going to really bring in that much more money.
Here's my thing about the progressive tax, and that was what we were arguing about last night. Like, I could have, I'm a representative. I could have seen myself vote for SB 21 if we talked about this progressive income tax brackets, the Kowalko tax brackets. And I know that Sean Lynn has produced something. We have some numbers. I don't know what those numbers sort of project to as far as revenue.
Yeah.
But what I do know is they should be tweaked upwards. Now, I'd be like, you want me to vote for SB 21? Fine. Pass the tax bill first. Let me see some numbers of getting people who are really benefiting from what we're doing here and getting some of that money back. Because that's the issue. Everybody uses us and uses us and uses us up, and we have no mechanism to get any of that back.
Yeah.
We just have to lay down every time because we're scared because it's 30% of the budget or whatever. Yep. And so I'm interested. I am interested to see, because my knee-jerk reaction would be that everybody's just going to forget about it, just like they always do. Okay, well, that's done. We solved that, which, again, is not solved.
Yeah.
And we should look to diversify our revenue sources or whatever. Yeah, that's nice on the day.
Yeah.
You know, so you don't get called, you know, Cuck Schumer or something. Yeah. But you're not, but so do it then.
So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if people do it. And there's 60 months till the primary, so you guys got your time.
Yeah, who's gonna lose? That's what I'm looking forward to see. Because I don't like a lot of you, so when you lose and you cry again, or I get reports of you having sort of episodes, sort of, you know, emotional episodes, I guess we'll call them. Can we call them emotional episodes? I think we can. I'm just going to laugh. Because you did it to yourself.
Yeah. So that's the first part. It's like the revenue obviously needs to change. The second part, and that's the part that I put in my piece, was we need an economic system that is more democratic. And you can call that socialism, you can call it whatever you want. But part of why something like this is even possible, I do think part of it is cowardice. But I think another part of it is there is a very real situation, like we talked about with DuPont, with MBNA, with whatever company that used to power GM, Chrysler. All those things, they can take their ball and leave. They essentially have the power to bully us by saying, like, well, if you don't do this or that thing that we want. I mean, this was the thing with the Amazon money. They're doing it with Merck now. They're doing, every time we give a company, the Port of Wilmington even, every time we promise to give one of these companies $50 million or we say we're going to cut these regulations or these taxes so that you come to us, the reason that that happens is because they have private control of vast sums of capital and wealth and money that the public has no control over. And so private individuals, and you can see this at the top level with Elon Musk. The reason he's able to do all this shit is because he has so much money. You wouldn't be able to, Doge would not exist if you didn't have the richest man in the world doing it. And so, you know, we can't fix all of that at Delaware, but what we can do is build more unions, create more cooperatives, bring things back into the public sector, stop selling shit off. Like, we need to do whatever we can to democratize wealth in Delaware. And there's a lot of different things that the state can do. I linked a good example in the piece from the Preston model and generally just like community wealth building, the Democracy Collaborative. There's organizations and groups that have policies written about ways that we can democratize wealth at the local level. Like, we don't have to fix everything nationwide. We're not going to be able to fix everything nationwide. But if we have more public assets, if we have more distributed wealth among like a cooperative group of people, then, you know, New York law firms and Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and all these corporations, DuPont, they are not going to be able to go to the Delaware state government and say, do this or we're leaving. It's not going to matter anymore. So I think that's my call to action for everybody, which is like whatever we can do to transfer that wealth downwards. It's not just an economic issue. It is a democracy issue. You can't have billionaires doing stuff like this and still say that we have functionally a democracy, because we don't.
And I think the point you made is you put yourself in the situation. You've privatized everything.
Yeah.
Actually, you paid for the privilege of giving away the public equity and the public good. You paid to give it away. And now that you've given it away, you have no control over it. It can just tell you what it wants to do. If it wants more money, they'll ask for more money or they'll leave. If it wants you to deregulate or overturn the Court of Chancery, that makes it even worse, is because we paid to sell off everything. You know, we had a garage sale where we paid people to take our shit, and now they haven't. They're using it against us.
Yep.
That's basically it.
That's what's going on. And I think, you know, there's some people who voted for this SB 49 or... that's another thing.
I almost fell out of my chair.
SB 21 and said, like, I don't want to do this, but we have to for whatever reason. And for those folks, like I said, if you want to put your money where your mouth is and like you really were just in a tight spot, whatever, you know, I'm a very forgiving person. Everybody knows this about me.
This is true. I'm not, but Carl will listen. He'll say, look, you want to work together to find some other to not be put in this situation and actually get solutions to this revenue issue,
yeah,
and start to get sort of public equity together and so that we reap the benefits of the things that we have, like deep water ports, for example. Talk to Carl. Don't talk to me, because I don't want to hear your bullshit, your crying bullshit. But Carl's like he's an organizer. He's a policy guy. He can put it together. He won't mind. That's what he does. He loves it. He's got a very good disposition for it.
Yeah. So if you're interested in talking about that, reach out to me. My information is public. You can go into the Working Families Party website. My email is there. You can text me. If you're the kind of person who is getting angry at me, I'm pretty sure you can probably find my number. So I think that would be my call to action for anybody who is interested in this stuff is like, what can we do to diversify revenue and what can we do to democratize our economy to make sure that something like this never happens again? And a lot of it's going to involve maybe doing what those WFT teachers did back in the 70s. Maybe we got to get a little bit more radical.
Yeah. And I will be tracking this, by the way. So for all of you who said, you know, I feel so bad, I know this is wrong, but there's really no other option here because our budget's at risk and everything. If you don't reach out because you're like, ew, Working Families Party, we're not going to, they're mean to me or whatever. If you don't do that, I'm going to know. And your life's not going to be pleasant. I just want to, I've got to be very clear about that. Because I don't like liars and people who talk behind people's backs. And I also don't like this idea that everybody's getting mad. It's really something to me. It's like, oh, you, like, what are we meant to do? Like these Democrats that hate the Working Families Party and hate me and hate it because we argue about everything or hate Medina or hate whatever. Like, what would they have us do? Like, how do they think this is supposed to work? Are we not supposed to be like, hey, we have a different idea. Here's our idea. You know, Carl wrote a 3-part series.
Let's bring it to the voters.
Yeah, let's bring it to the voters and see what they think. The other thing that's going to make people real mad is that Elon Heil Hitler next to people on Lit next year. They're going to be real mad. And I'm telling you right now, that's tough shit.
Yeah, and I don't have any control over that. So I could tell them, like, please don't do that. But they're not going to listen to me because that's the thing about PACs is that we're not allowed to coordinate. So.
Yeah, there's going to be no coordination. But what you're going to see is you're going to see your face there looking up at a podium while Elon Heil Hitler's. And again, you could do the thing that Meyer did on CNBC with Andrew Ross Sorkin. And you can be like, it's not about Elon. Elon who? Doesn't matter. That doesn't matter to it. See, that's what you did. That's how you talk. That's the dumb shit that you say. It's not about Elon. We don't care about that. I'm going to make sure that some of these shady organizations that you're so afraid of are going to make some. I mean, there are going to be some Lit out there that you're not going to like. And I really think the only thing you can do is quit now. That's really the only. That's your only option. Because your primary reelection campaign next year is going to be excruciatingly painful for you. I'm going to fucking make sure of it. So just keep that in mind. And if you don't like it, I don't care. Because that's what democracy is. I mean, you know, everybody loves democracy. That's what I'm being told. They love it and they are afraid that it's going away. So I'm going to do a little democracy by being adversarial in the political arena. That's just because I love democracy. I love it. It's great. You can't tell me I don't love it. So there. Well, the one thing I did learn, and I you know, I had the little cold open today because I did listen to about a half hour of public comment on SB 21. And then I also spoke to some people who had spoken to some other representatives about another issue, about some other public safety type of issue. So I'm getting all of this information, and I couldn't help but realize that most interactions, like if you have another idea or you're trying to do what we would call reform or something different, going down there and scheduling 15 minutes with somebody for them to tell you it's not the right time, or we did that before, or the other people have to do it, the other caucus or the other person, you're wasting your fucking time with that. I know that you like to go down there and you put on your suit or your nice shoes and you tread across the marble flooring and you go see somebody who you call senator and you've seen their name in the paper and it's really exciting to go talk to them and have them pat you on the head, give you a sweet or a candy or something and send you on your way because they can't do anything. I would suggest don't do that. Join up with us and we'll get people who are interested in reform and are interested in, public good and are interested in actually solving problems. and not math problems on an Excel spreadsheet. Real world problems of real people that work. You know, not making sure, you know, that the formula runs and the numbers come out. Because I the people I know, they don't, that's not how they eat or pay their rent. So that's all I have to say about that.
Yep.
Here's what I'm gonna say. Upcoming shows. I definitely want to talk to some legislators that I admire. I like what they're doing. You'll hear from them soon. So many of them I have never spoken with, at least on here. Also, trying to speak with the two women who run Lead Free Delaware. I've had a couple of side conversations with Sarah and, don't tell me, Amy. Sarah and Amy. Yeah, I'm hoping to get them on to talk about their work, how they got into it. But also, you know, these are, you know, very active advocates in Delaware. So I'd like to pick their brain a little bit about, like, the general landscape, because I feel like, and we're seeing this after the SB 21 thing, we're seeing different types of people getting pretty mad, pretty sort of activated, we'll say. Activated is a good word. So I'm interested to speak with them. And I have to tell you that this series, this epic audio history of the noble and holy order of the Knights of Labor called Storm the Fort, is going to be, it's going to blow your mind how good it is. You're going to be like, this is like, is this PBS? Is this Blowback? Like, what am I listening to right now? This is incredible. Just wait. There's a lot of things we can do with this medium, this sort of media thing we're doing, and we're going to keep doing it all. Can't wait. April 10th, right?
April 10th.
April 10th, two a week.
Two a week. So if you want to binge it a little bit.
Too much. I'm giving them too much again. It will be fun to binge because I'll sort of break character here. I think I'm going to be able to actually do some like final edit or have a final listen to a full episode soon, which I haven't, for bits and pieces and, you know, maybe helped out a little bit. We'll see. We'll see how that works. But yeah, I'm actually already excited to be able to hear a full episode before anybody else, because I know, you know, the parts that I've heard are just phenomenal. And I'm so proud that it was produced here in the Highlands Bunker studio.
Yep.
Love it. Yeah, we got so much we're doing. Can't even believe it. Didn't even talk about police reform stuff. Didn't even talk about it. So much. Well, I'm sure you will link to your call pieces.
Yep.
We have a couple other things coming in the call too, so stay tuned for that. Should be very interesting stuff, topical stuff you like. And again, if you like what we're doing here on the podcast, please consider going to patreon.com/thehighlandsbunker and throwing us $5-$10. I will say that we have had a little influx of, we've had a little upturn here in the last 4 to 6 weeks. I appreciate that from everybody. Thank you so much for everybody kind of popping in and showing us some love, supporting the work. We very much appreciate it. And yeah, we'll speak to you next week. Left is best.